it ain't. Mr. Becker, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This case arises out of Miller Gutter's election to voluntarily dismiss its claim against American Family without prejudice. The question presented by this case, or what conditions that the court can impose on that exercise of that statutory right under Nebraska Revised Statute 25601. Although 25601 says that you have the right to voluntarily dismiss your action at any time before final submission, there was clearly no final submission of the facts and law at this case at the time that Miller Gutter elected to exercise its right.
What about the final submission on those three claims on which the trial court had already granted summary judgment in favor of American Family?
Under the definition of final submission, that does not meet the Nebraska statute or the Nebraska case law definition of what a final submission is. A final submission is a submission that leaves nothing at all to be adjudicated.
What was left with respect to those three claims?
That's precisely the point. Those three claims are part of a larger umbrella of claims brought in this case. They didn't even move for total summary judgment. It was a partial summary judgment that they sought.
And with respect to those three claims, what was left to be resolved?
There was nothing left to be resolved with respect to those three claims at that time. And as we indicated at the hearing, that becomes law of the case. And in a subsequent proceeding, if a new suit is filed, then they're free to come back and say, that's law of the case. That's been adjudicated and didn't appeal. But that does not transform that into a final submission of all issues of law and fact, which is the definition that this court has used in past precedent as to what constitutes a final submission. By virtue of getting around that summary judgment and having issues left to decide, then there were still issues left for a final submission to the jury on issues of law or fact. There was something left to be concluded which prevented final submission.
So are you assigning any error at all to the court's rulings on summary judgment?
No.
Thank you.
And I don't think that we could under the case law, and I think that that's reflected in the colloquy between myself and the court. But that doesn't transform it into a final submission. One thing I would note is it doesn't matter what our motivations were. I didn't go into all of our motivations. Those are extraneous, those are work product and attorney-client privilege, and there could have been 30 different reasons why we elected to do what we elected to do. But at the time that we elected to voluntarily dismiss that morning, we had an offer to confess that was outstanding, that we contemplated accepting. In fact, that morning I had two different pleadings. I could have either dismissed the action or I could have accepted the outstanding offer to confess that had been issued that Friday, that was still valid in effect on that Monday and would have been continued to be in effect for several days into the trial. If we had accepted that, would the court have assessed jury cost to the defendant? Is there any case which suggests that? If we had accepted that offer to confess, is there any basis for the court to assess the costs of extra jurors who are never even impaneled? I submit that there's nothing in Nebraska case law history, let alone statutory process, that indicates such costs can be assessed.
Doesn't 25602 talk about dismissal upon payment of costs?
And impaneling a jury, the theoretical costs, when you have four other jury trials that day, of bringing in some extra jurors because the judge on his own decides he wants some extra jurors because he thinks somebody might have a conflict, when you don't even have an impanelment of the jury, that's not a cost. There is no Nebraska statute that defines as a taxable cost the notion that some extra jurors were brought in a total pool of jurors available for multiple other cases.
So what costs are taxable under 25602, in your opinion?
Well, this is a dismissal under 601. It's not 602.
Is it your position that 602 has no application to a dismissal under 601?
Yes, and I think that there is prior case law that says that. I mean, it's unreported, but by way of example, Ritzel versus Ritzel.
A court of appeals case,
right. But what that case says, costs mean things such as filing fees, sheriff fees for service of process, and statutory witness fees. There was no motion to tax costs. If they had had witnesses that they had served sheriff fees on and presented witnesses and brought a motion to tax costs, we wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be contesting that. But when you have an extraneous assessment of an unimpaneled jury, I think that's improper because there's no statutory basis. There's no recognition as a common course of procedure to assess such costs. Similarly, the cost of deciding you want to electronically present evidence and having some court reporter there to facilitate the electronic presentation of evidence, again, is not a taxable cost. This court recently said in the McGill versus Lyon Place decision that it disavows that line of cases that suggests that there can be the assessment of these extraneous costs of litigation that aren't enumerated in statute. And that's precisely what that is. Just like all the cases say, you cannot assess attorney fees, the expense of double litigation, the risk, which it hasn't even been presented to them yet, is simply a burden that they assume and they're subject to under the right of dismissal. That decision to use some person to facilitate the electronic presentation of evidence is merely another form of attorney fee costs. It's the same thing as trying to bill in Westlaw charges or other things that this court has rejected as a recoverable cost. It's simply not enumerated in any statute, and the decision...
So does this all come down to statutory interpretation, or do we have some abuse of discretion here? What's our standard of review?
I think the standard of review is de novo, because it's a question of law. And I don't think under the case law that the court had the ability to award the electronic presentation of evidence, did not have the authority to tax, in the absence of any request, the costs of an unimpaneled jury that hadn't even been impaneled yet.
That's the 2000?
Yes.
Okay.
And then it certainly didn't have the ability, I think, to suggest that any other case has to be assigned to it. What if we decided that part of the problem with this case was the fact that we had 50-plus claims, and we decided the better course of action would be to separate and file each one of those in county court. And in fact, two of these claims, the work actually occurred in Sauk County, but we consolidated them all together, no one raised any issue. If I decide to file two of those claims in Sauk County where the work was done, and the other 48 plus in Douglas County County Court, because they're all below that jurisdictional threshold, does American Family suddenly get to come in and say, oh, we're going to transfer it all back to Judge Wheelock and consolidate it all? I don't think that's within the judge's power. I think that the more appropriate analysis of it is under the, and albeit I acknowledge that it's an unreported case, but it's Judge Irwin's analysis in the Lee versus Fletcher case, the unreported court appeals case cited in our brief. And what that said is a voluntary dismissal ends the litigation. A dismissal need not even be entered by the court.
What does 602 say about the timing when a motion to dismiss without prejudice is filed? When does it become effective?
Becomes effective, well, this is under 601, so I disagree with the suggestion this is under 602. But with respect to 602, I think it's upon the filing. When we file before any pronouncements by the court, in the absence of any motion for attorney fees, motion to tax costs, any request for relief, any counterclaim pled by American Family, it was done.
Doesn't 25602 say that a dismissal without prejudice is effective upon payment of costs once the clerk of the court spreads it on the journal?
Well, I can pull it out, but I frankly submit that I don't think under the case law that this is a dismissal under 602. We're exercising our right to dismiss under 601.
Indulge me for a minute. Under 602, was there ever a dismissal spread on the journal in this case?
There was an order that says the case is dismissed without prejudice, and there's an oral pronouncement by the court. I do not know if it was spread upon the journal, and I don't think the record reflects that. I also think that that section talks about, in the context of the... have the right in the vacation of any said courts to dismiss said action without prejudice. I think, frankly, that is just an additional option, but when you exercise the right under 601, I don't think 602 even applies.
Okay.
The court disagrees. The court disagrees. I think under that unreported case I talked about that draws the distinction, we're not even getting into 602. I can reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bacon, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Joel Bacon. I represent the Appalachian American Family Insurance Company. I do think the flaw in the appellant's argument here is their claim that the ability to dismiss under 25601 is absolute. It isn't. There are limitations on it that this court has recognized that are embodied in the statute. The first is the final submission rule. Once an action has been finally submitted, the ability to dismiss that action is limited. This court has also recognized for well over 100 years that where justice and equity require, the court can impose conditions under a dismissal on 25601. And then in addition to that, if the defendant seeks affirmative relief, the court can also, the plaintiff can't avoid that affirmative relief if the court, by trying to dismiss. I do want to jump into a little bit of background on this case because I think it's at least of some importance to what occurred here. This is a case that involves 48 claims for hail insurance. They were all consolidated into one action at the plaintiff's choice. The matter was filed in 2015, and then it proceeded. We filed an initial motion to dismiss. We were successful on three of our four claims on that motion to dismiss. Those claims would have been a bad faith claim and then the two statutory claims that were also alleged.
There seems to be no debate that that would be law of the case, were the case to proceed.
That's my understanding what the, I think the appellant said that during the course of the discussion that occurred after the dismissal was filed, and I think that's what they're saying here today. So what I take that to mean is that they're conceding that point and that those claims could not be filed again. I do think that's consistent with the idea that that was a final submission, and I also think it's consistent with the idea that it's justice and equity. We won this. That's a victory fairly won, and they can't go and now file, as you, Mr. Becker suggested, they can refile this in county court in front of potentially dozens of different judges on the hopes that they might get one of those claims in front of a judge who would be acceptable to it. And so that would be unfair to us. I mean, that's the epitome of justice.
Counsel, the district judge still could have changed his mind about any of those prior summary judgments, correct?
Yeah, I think the court would always have the ability to reconsider.
They were interlocutory, correct?
I think that's fair, yes.
And if they are interlocutory, how is it consistent to say that that's a final submission?
I think Professor Lenich has written a large article on this, and he draws a distinction between a final judgment and a final submission. And a final submission is consistent with the idea that each one of these things is an individual action, and once we've submitted it, then it becomes a final submission on that. Each claim for relief becomes a final submission on that, so it is different than the final judgment concept.
So what happens to a final submission if the judge elects to change his mind? Is it become an unfinal submission?
I think the judge would have the ability to pull back and say, I've changed my mind. And if the judge does change his mind, it's just like if the order had been overruled.
Thank you.
With respect to the cost issue, one of the things I think to understand is, again, the history of the case here. This matter was pending for almost 2 years. Both parties had indicated to Judge Wheelock that the matter needed to be litigated because it had been pending for so long. Judge Wheelock took extra steps to make sure the case would be heard. And so week aside, we'd already been moved one time because a criminal case got in front of us. He took extra steps to make sure a criminal case wouldn't get in front of us so we could have it tried.
Is this your justice and equity argument?
Yeah, this ties into that, that it is part of this, but where costs can be justified, this court has long recognized that one of the conditions a court can impose on the ability to dismiss is the imposition of costs. Now, I do think there's an issue.
So how far can the judge go with costs?
I agree with that. I think there's a fair question on whether or not when the court says costs, does that mean traditional notions of taxable costs or not? And there is some case law in Nebraska that actually, I think, is enlightening on what that actually means. It ties that idea that in the notion that the court can't award attorney's fees, I think that's open and shut, that a court can't tie this to attorney's fees. But the court has said that risk of double litigation can be compensated by the imposition of costs, and some of the language in the case would suggest that's especially true when there's been an unreasonable delay in presenting the motion to dismiss.
Can you be more specific as to the costs that the judge imposed?
Yeah, the judge imposed.
So we have, like, the cost to the taxpayers of bringing in a jury or a big panel.
Yes, the judge
and
imposed.
And then what, and the court reporters?
Judge imposed two different types of costs. One was $2,000 for the jury fees that the county incurred. And we stipulated that was fair and reasonable on the record. They didn't stipulate that those could be awarded, but the stipulation was that if they were awarded, that was a fair and reasonable amount. And then the other cost was $1,650 related to technology costs. We brought in a third party to provide technology. And it was a complex case. I think there were probably going to be thousands of pages of exhibits to review. So that was why we did that. I do think it's worth noting that the award of costs on the technology were actually very narrow. They were related to the cost for setup on the Friday before the trial, as well as the day of trial when the technology provider appeared and was there to help us.
What's your best authority that the litigants would be charged not for a jury panel or a extra large jury panel?
I think there's two cases in Nebraska that I was able to, well, one I was able to find and then one the amicus cited, which frankly I missed. There's a case from, which we cite in our brief, the Frazier case from the early 1900s that where there was an award of juror fee that was awarded as costs. And then,
can you tell what the juror fee even was in the early 1900s?
I tried to figure that out for sure, and I frankly couldn't. So I even went and looked at the old statute book, and I still couldn't figure that out. And there's also a case that the amicus cited the county cited in their amicus brief from the 70s, which is kind of an interesting case. There was a dismissal underneath the statute. I think the plaintiff realized they had dismissed beyond the statute of limitations. And so they asked the court to set aside their dismissal under a motion for new trial. And the judge in that case said, I'll do that, but if I'm going to do that, you're going to have to pay a juror fee because we're going to do that. And this court allowed that to go forward. So I think both of those cases would support there are at least some situations where a juror fee can be awarded.
So, asked a different way, what is the rule or the message that we should give to litigants and trial attorneys about awarding costs?
I think when you're getting, I think it ties into was there a delay here? And if there was a delay, what was the effect of that delay? I think ultimately that lies in the trial court's discretion. I would envision.
So the trial court has to look at, for example, who caused the delay.
Yeah. Could this notice of this have been given sooner? And here there's some indication in the record that notice of this could have at least been given. You take them at their word for the reason why they dismissed, as it's laid out in the record, at least a week ahead of time. And had that occurred, then this jury would not have shown up and had to be dismissed because they dismissed the case.
Excuse me, but in real life, there's an offer to confess sitting out there, and that gets people's attention.
That's true. If the offer of confess had been accepted, though, the case would have ended. Now we're looking at costs that we're going to have to duplicate again down the line when we go to trial again. I mean, we're going to have to bring in the technology provider again. And those costs, had they told us on Thursday before trial, we're going to dismiss the case. Had they been indicating that we were going to dismiss the case and said, we're definitely going to call witnesses, we could have avoided those costs, and we're going to have to pay those costs again if we go to trial.
You've mentioned unreasonable delay a couple of times in your argument. Are you referring to 25.824?
That, I think, is in play as well, and 25.824 does talk about a timeliness component, and I think that's where this comes into play. And we did raise 25.824 in our answers.
Did the judge make any findings, either on the record or in his order, that could arguably be tied to 25.824?
It's probably not squarely there. I think there's a reference in the written order about it being based on the facts of this case. I think it's reasonable to impose the technology costs. There was, I think, a discussion, and again, the amicus cites at length in their brief, on the record that occurred about the judge's concern with respect to the jury. I think other cases, when you have a true sanctions case, you might see more clear records. One of the things that was going on here is we were all thinking on the fly, at least on our side of it, because we were there to try a case, not to deal with dismissal. And I think that's true for Judge Wheelock too. A lot of effort getting ready for this case.
But there was no particular finding of unreasonable delay or frivolousness in this case. Is that right?
I think it's a fair characterization. It's almost out of time, so unless there's any additional questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? We have 10 seconds, Mr. Becker. We'll actually give you 30 seconds.
Thank you. I think it comes down to, if you're going to assess something like cost, that's the province of the unicameral. There are states that have late settlement fees that they can impose. Our unicameral has chosen not to do that and has chosen not to delineate the cost of impaneling a jury or the cost of bringing in potential jurors that aren't even impaneled as a cost. As indicated, we could have accepted that offer to confess that morning. What would have happened to that expense? It's reflective of its punitive that we exercise our statutory right. This court has said is a right. It's not a matter of judicial discretion or grace. It is a statutory right. We exercise that right. The court's going to invade the province of the unicameral. I just respectfully submit the question of a late settlement assessment for things like jury costs is within the province of the unicameral. And there's nothing to indicate that that is a cost the unicameral has enunciated and decided that should be delineated as potentially assessable. And again, on 25A24, there was no motion and no reference of that. And if there had been, we would have had a more thorough record to address the issue.
Thank you very much.